Well, persons, how is that? It's sometimes hard to come back into language, and it's interesting to explore the generation of languaging without needing a self to produce it, you know, or understanding language without needing a self to comprehend it. There is comprehension, there is awareness, there are even purposes, there are good intentions. There are the executive functions. Is there actually a coherent, stable, self-arising owner and agent? So what did you experience? How was that for you?
So what is it?
Self?
No, what is it? It's not I and it's not self. What is it?
What is what?
What he thinks of himself, he's not supposed to.
this thing, this consciousness, this awareness, what is it?
It's not an it.
What?
No, I don't mean that at all disrespectfully or okay. It's there is a wearing. There are mind objects appearing and disappearing. There are causal streams flowing through, congealed to some extent as a body. But even the body, over the course of a year, exchanges a lot of its atoms. You know, we're standing streaming in a way. It's like a standing wave. There's a stability to it. The pattern is fairly stable, but its elements are changing. That's the knowing, that's the sense of it. So, is that at your question or tangential? Well, it's interesting to look. That's a great question. I'll say a way. Let's do this. If you could hold that question or comment. So, I invite you to look at the slide. I guess it's on your page 14 at the very bottom. It's the second slide after the Lord of the Rings slide, where we look at the properties of self as experienced. So when we go back to this it, right? What is it? Although it reminds me a little bit of this snappy dialogue I heard when I was a freshman, I think, in college. Somebody said to somebody else, "What do you mean, da 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 da?" The other person said, "What do you mean?" You know, right? So what did you notice? I suspect that you noticed that I, or self, was an object of awareness. It was held within awareness. No? It was not awareness itself. To the extent it arose, maybe it didn't arise for you at all. No?
I think
awareness
is the same.
Why do we need to add I to awareness?
It's just the way I identify it.
Right. The Buddha was... Yeah.
Just like you just said, though, look at your outline.
Right. I'm using that word as person. There's a body who has your outline. It's not hers. If you reached for hers, there'd be trouble, you know? There's two persons here. And again, this is for you to see for yourself, but the Buddha also was quite cautious with people about identifying or with awareness and ascribing to awareness qualities of self. Buddha, the conventional notion of self is a subject of experience, the one to whom experience happens, who owns experience, and is an agent. So in other words, it's an entity, a being, who identifies with things and owns them and causes them. So those are the three, you could say, functions of selfing: identification, ownership, and agency. And that's what you look for in a child. You want a child to develop a healthy sense of self. It's a raft. But the Buddha was very cautious about identifying with awareness or owning it or feeling like we cause it. Because when you look, there's just awareness. And so my point is that, like, if you say, "What kind of a person are you, Rick?" I would think about certain traits that I identify with myself. Those thoughts are all objects of awareness. They're not awareness itself. When something happens that I particularly don't like or do like, and again, I broadly defined as a person, and the Buddha used the word I. It's interesting. We've thought about that. Like, why did he use that word I? I think he really meant it just as a person. You know, it's a convenient tag. This one over here. So when I say I mean this one over here. Anyway. Often what you'll notice is that there's a reaction to something. There's desire. Like, I don't like it or I do like it. Or there's, rather, more exactly, there's disliking or there's liking. And then on the heels of that, within a second or two, you can watch self start to constellate in the mind. You can watch the lights, the circuits start to light up. You know, I think of it as like on a stereo, you see the lights going up and coming down, coming up, coming down. Self activating, deactivating, you know. And as I'll show you in a moment, a slide, different parts of the brain light up or get quiet depending on what aspects of self are activating. It's just spread out all over the place. And all that are, I think if you look at your experience, you'll see, without me saying it's that way, just it is, you see it that way, that those are all arising in the mind. I think very often desire constellates a self. Desire creates a self at least as much as self has desires. Right?
Could you say what those three qualities of selfing are before we get any further again?
Yeah. In psychology and even in the Dharma, it's identification, right? I am a Democrat. I am a man. I'm a 49er fan. 49ers win, I'm happy. 49ers lose, life sucks, right? Not exactly. I'm a selective fan. When they're winning, I loved them. I may love them again. We'll see. Anyway, I like Mike Singletary. So, anyway, see? I like Mike Singletary. A second main characteristic is ownership. My car, my dog, my house. You know, identification and ownership often go together. You know, my sports team, right? And then last, agency. I'm going to run for office. I'm going to eat pizza tonight. I'm going to think about how I could answer some of these questions better on the drive home, maybe. You know, I'm going to make that happen. I'm going to swing a hammer and hit a nail. Agency.
Well, what does agency mean? I don't get that.
It means being causal. Okay. Agency means cause, like an agent. Okay. In that sense, that's the technical meaning of it. And that's how we experience it, don't we? We feel literally like we're the owner of experiences. We're the one to whom they happen. We identify with certain things like family or home or place or nation, religion sometimes. And also, we are the source of action. In other words, and those qualities are actually really important for a healthy mind. Being able to identify with or have some sense of relatedness to something, like, you know, the Dalai Lama talks about my watch. I like my watch. It's one of his few possessions as a monk. He, you know, there's okay. Where it gets troublesome is when we go overboard with it. Okay. In other words, to a healthy mind, you want to have a healthy sense of agency rather than learned helplessness. You want to also, it's a terrible psychiatric disorder or brain damage where someone feels derealized. They don't feel real anymore. They don't feel like, I mean, actions are happening, they don't feel like they're causing them. You know, or they feel like, well, Satan made me do it, or, you know, God was talking through me and that's why I hijacked that airplane in Mexico recently or something. That's mental illness, that's insanity. So we want some sense of agency. The trick is not to identify with agency or identify with identification. These are streams. These are processes. That's the point. They're real and they happen here. You know, this guy's form of identification and agency and that which this guy identifies with is different from what that guy or that gal identifies with, right? They arise for real. But that which they point to, and the conventional presumption is there's a subject of experience, an agent of actions, that self arises independent of conditions, that exists independent of conditions. And there is no such thing. That's the teaching of the Dharma. We have to see that for ourselves. And we may or may not experience it, and often there is sudden awakening, gradual cultivation around that. I could personally say, not just factually, because I think it's important to honor the insights that you actually have. You have to watch the pitfalls of claiming them and making them special. But for the first time in my life, over the course of the summer, I had a completely direct experience that there couldn't possibly be a self, that it was so complicated. So much was happening, so much was zooming around. There couldn't possibly be one person, one being, one entity owning and directing all that. You know. So then there's gradual cultivation, right? But that's the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's teaching is that there is not that one. There are many representations of that one in the mind, right? And sometimes it works to kind of conventionally play act that one. But that which those all point to is a unicorn. It's a mythical beast. There is no unicorn. That's the teaching. We are to see for ourselves what is true about that.
And there's so much programming, I and me and mine and all of those things that are filled with greed and the rest of those things. So it's difficult for me to even talk about this, because I begin to see the I, which is the obstacle of what's being talked about, that really feels like the reality. So what I noticed in doing this was what you talked about, Gail, about music. When I was able to not separate myself, but see kind of beyond the I part, then I just was chanting inside.
Yeah.
So the chanting cleared up the obstacle of I. So I thought, well, isn't this interesting, you know, the chant. So I stopped chanting and it's right back there. The I, you know, kind of fills that space. Wow.
Well, right there is so observable. Again, this little properties of self as experienced is one of the handful of really important little slides here to look at. Just like you said, self came and went, right? If self were such, if self were what we normally consider it to be, it doesn't come and go. It's not variable. Isn't that so interesting? Direct observation is that the constituents of self are variable. Certain aspects light up, certain aspects light down. Please, you.
I had a similar experience. Maybe I could try to say it better. There was walking, and no perceptible thoughts of me, mine, I. Then there was some thoughts of me, mine. But then there was awareness that while those thoughts were taking place, there was still walking, so who was making that walking happen? You know, it wasn't the me, mine. It was thinking about something else.
Yeah. It's interesting to observe how often in life there is little self present or no self. Reach for the pepper. You know, it's sometimes people talk about automatic action. Sometimes you'll see people talk about this in a very pejorative sense because they're embedded in this Western tradition, but they call it zombie mode. Mm-hmm. But maybe zombie mode is awakened mode. You know, maybe there's no zombie at all. It is just what's there. Yeah.
Or maybe one is like you're just now talking about. Some things are diseases. But looking at the same sort of behavior with a different level of awareness, it's not.
Yeah.
Why is that just not lack of awareness?
Zombie mode?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes one can be aware of walking, and walking is occurring, and obviously the subroutines that manage the motor act of walking, which is hard to teach a robot to do. It's even hard to teach a baby to do, right? It takes a year or so. Anyway, there could be awareness of it.
But you were saying reaching for the salt shaker.
Oh, there's awareness of reaching for the salt shaker. It's not unconscious. But there's not...
The person may not be aware of it.
Or there's maybe a kind of a, in the sidelines awareness of the reaching. There's chewing, swallowing, thought, maybe or maybe not verbalized, needs salt, wish for salt, hand reaches for salt. And you see for yourself, it's interesting to watch the subtleties of increases or decreases of selfing. It's an incredible teaching that's so available right here and now with salt shakers. A conversation to see. And you start, you just start watching. You know, I comes in, I fades out. I is very activated by greed and hatred. You know, greed and hatred are what comes first. The parade gets going, the neural cascade. You know, you start watching the thoughts within a second or two. They say something. Often self arises interpersonally. You know, in other words, you're just kind of rolling along, mainly just sort of being, in the body, hanging, right? And then they say something to you kind of insulting or alarming, right? For men, often it's a communication of suppressing autonomy. For women, often, as a generalization, it's a communication that sounds like a threat to intimacy or joining. Either way. Let's not get too far into that one, but either way, right, it comes at you. You walk by your kid, and your kid doesn't say hello, or just kind of looks at you and looks away. Something happens, it's unpleasant, there's a response to the unpleasant, and then self chases after. You know, self arises in the formations. Quick review, five aggregates. Form, which is all of materiality, and the most elemental apprehension of materiality. That's it. That's right there, the Buddha handled the whole physical universe and the barest apprehension of it. Then comes the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Then perception, you know, labeling, what is it? And then come all the volitional formations, all the feelings, the thoughts, the plans, the action, the executive programs, the attitude, the psychodynamics, the inner conflict, all that is the formations. And then, and there's consciousness kind of as a field in which all that occurs. Okay? Self's in the formations. Andy Alinsky said that to me a while back. He's a wonderful teacher, always worth reading. He writes a column, I think, for Buddha Dharma or Tricycle. Anyways, at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. He said, self is in the formations. If you look, you don't find self in the feeling tone. It's interesting, isn't it? It comes after. And in the processing cascade in the brain, what comes first is the percept, that's like form. And then the feeling tone occurs really fast. In other words, we're walking on the trail. There's this curvy object. Unpleasant. We're back. Then 1, 2, 3, 4 seconds later in the processing cascade, snake or stick, right? But we jump back first, right? So it makes sense. I always wondered, why does feeling come first, right? Because don't we label it and then we have an attitude or reaction to it? But the Buddha was so wise. Because he's watching this stuff. His mind is so quiet. Those guys' minds are so quiet. Sometimes our minds today. They can just see this stuff happen in the first sixth of a second. It takes about 100 milliseconds. It takes about a tenth of a second for a thought to form. Most of what we're aware of in the world, we're probably about, you know, a 20th of a second behind. Like, right, whatever you're hearing and seeing right now has already happened about a 20th of a second before you got it, if not a tenth or a fifth of a second. Which is really trippy to kind of, it's like Matrix stuff. Is there a spoon, you know?
What's the hatred? That's a pretty strong word. I mean,
yeah, okay. But the point I'm making is that to keep an animal alive, you got to know to jump first, think later. Jump first, label later. In other words, Vedana first, perception later. But in the Vedana, in the feeling tone, and in the perception, and even in the action, there's often not much sense of self, right? Have you ever had that happen? You jump back in alarm and you quickly react. Self requires a lot of processing power, right? And self evolved to help us survive. And it especially helped us socially, interpersonally, okay? But if you need self to activate, to figure out what to do with a crisis, you're going to be eaten, or the snake's going to bite you, or you're going to crash your car. Right? Self is good for long-term planning, but not for immediate reactions. My larger point is you can just see right there in so much of what's happening in awareness, there ain't no self. ain't no self in the feeling tone or perception. And the reason I use hatred is that's the traditional term for the whole spectrum of aversive reactions or reactions to that which is unpleasant.
So for me, it's aversion and hatred or something that's unpleasant. Are you saying hatred is really
the three poisons? Greed, hatred, and aversion.
Or delusion.
Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Okay. I'm meaning by hatred, I'm meaning the whole range of reactions to that which is unpleasant. So unpleasant is on a range from extremely subtle stuff to searing agony. Right? And our reaction to that is on a whole range from the subtlest form of apprehension or fear or irritation all the way to nuclear war.
On the other hand, a hand comes out with the begging bowl. So I could just be aware and go, ceramic dish. Human hand. Or myself would go, person needs food.
Do you need a self to have that understanding of the begging bowl and its context?
Well, where does my compassion come from?
Do you need a self for compassion to be present? Why?
Why not? I mean, I need there's an entity that does this. I mean, if he holds the begging bowl out to a tree, the tree will not put anything there. So there's a different entity. I'm a different entity than the tree, though the word entity.
Yeah.
Or if he holds the bowl out to a wolf, the wolf will respond in a completely different way. So somehow those entities are constituted differently, that their responses, it's not a universal self that always responds to the begging bowl in the same way. So something defines, there are other people who would slap the bowl away and say, get the hell out of my way. So these are different, somehow these are different entities that control this event. So whatever the word you is, there's something that defines this row of entities, and it isn't an emptiness in that regard. We respond, and compassion requires that. Somehow.
So frame is ehipasiko, see for ourselves, right? Including here. And wonderful to grapple with this so intensely. For many, it's considered this is the thorniest of it all, you know, and to try to, and so for me, when we're grappling with a really thorny, complex, messy, murky thing in which we have a lot of investment because it's I who's investigating the end of I, right? It really helps to slow it down. It's like having an argument with your spouse. It helps to really slow it down and define your terms, not linguistically, but just for clarity's sake, and then kind of unpack it one step at a time. So first off, we have two persons. We have the monk and the villager, okay? So the monk recognizes that a villager is different from a tree or a wolf or someone outside the village who is not at all related to Buddhism and alms offerings. Okay? Questions for investigation. Does that recognition in the mind of the monk that arises in awareness as a mind object, does that recognition require an I? Can it arise without I? Right? And that's for you to see. I think it can. Just like, move your head around the room. There is recognition of different things that move into the field of awareness, the field of vision. Does there need to be I present for the effortless recognition of what they are, for the arising even of a feeling tone about them, and a knowing what to do about them? You know, it is said that in awareness there are three things. For me, these have been useful. There's vijnana, which is consciousness. There is sati, which is just knowing, the knowing faculty of mind. That's mindfulness of sati. And sampajana, which is kind of knowing about it. Those can all arise in a selfless way. You know, particularly if you just kind of do deliberate things, like you just move your eyes around. And especially if you kind of allow it to be surprised. Watch what happens in the first half second or 1 to 3 seconds before self gets all involved. You know, it sounds like Peter Pan. Then, second, in the mind of the villager. For the villager to recognize the monk and the bull, does self need to be present for the recognition, including the larger understanding of the place of the monk in the larger scheme of things, or a larger valuing of offering dana, generosity? Does there need to be a self, an I, for that notion to arise, including the emotions of that emotion, of that recognition? In other words, does I need to be present for anger or sadness or love or compassion to be present? But there is compassion.
The history of experience present, and that experience has to be experienced by something.
That experience arose, so it helps to slow it down. That experience arose in a particular embodied nervous system, the villager, and it arose over time, and the villager associated different things to those experiences, including pleasure and reward and wholesome reward, that then inclined the villager increasingly to put a banana in the bowl, right? But again, in the Dharma, does there need to be an absolute self-existing I for any of those things to happen?
What's the difference between the villager and the self?
A villager is a body that has a nervous system, that has a mind. Mind being the flow of information, which often stabilizes in eddies, some of which are very transient, some of which last a lifetime.
What is a self? That's my definition of a self is a villager with a mind and a functional nervous system.
That's great.
So what is a self?
That's a wonderful thing. I'm deliberately calling out and carving out person for that. Villager with a body, a history, a nervous system, learnings and patterns that are unique to that person, and a person that has moral responsibility. It's a very interesting issue in Buddhist ethics, isn't it? If there's no self, why are you culpable if you pull the trigger? Right? Well, there is moral responsibility, and there also is someone in the sense of person who suffers. Now, I think how the Buddha meant self, he meant as a soul, Atman, right? That was his critique of, that's what anatta is, right? Quick review. So in Hinduism of the time, 2,500 years ago, one of the major doctrines was that there was an Atman, a soul, that had an absolute existence, that somehow arose with the universe and bounced from life to life to life, but retained a kind of absolute coherence that did not depend on conditions. The Buddha said, no, everything depends on conditions. Right? Which is tough for the Mahayanans, who think that there is some kind of ultimate absolute consciousness or Buddha nature that does not depend on conditions. They may be right, they may be not right, who knows? But the Pali Canon's really crystal clear, pretty clear. There are these little carve-outs that people say are the loopholes, you know, but even other people would say, well, you're misunderstanding those loopholes. But the Buddha basically said, for sure, your notion of a soul ain't true. See, for yourself, but he said it ain't true. That's what he mostly meant. Now, in the West, this is good, hang on. It's not my opinion. I'm just trying to, well, it's my opinion of what the Dharma is, if you will, and then we see for ourselves if that's actually what the Dharma is. In the West, we usually don't mean self that way. We usually mean Rick, Christy, Kathy, I forget your name, but what is your name?
Steve,
right? We think of it as the personality. And we do also think of it in Western moral philosophy as the one who has intentions and is responsible for them. And we do think of it like that. And that's the way in which I'm using the term self here. As the one who experiences experience, the one who endures, like the one who is the same today deep down as was present in your first memory. That's right. And what the Buddha's argument is, and I totally think is supported by the neurology, is there ain't such a one. There are representations of such a one that are supported by the neural substrate, but what they point to don't exist, just like the Buddha said. Right? There is compassion, there is love, there is large-heartedness. There doesn't need to be necessarily an entity that's always the same that's looking out through the eyes. Tell you what, I have a suggestion, just in the interest of time. How about we name all the questions or comments kind of briskly? I won't say a word. I'll fight these tendencies. And then we'll figure out what to do with this mess. And I do want to show you a few pretty pictures. Okay?
I have a suggestion, which is that I have gotten this in brief moments, and I think I got how it relates to dependent co-origination. And I think if the usefulness of it became clear, of like Buddhism being so useful, that when people could hold their questions, when you talk about the suffering of it, then it becomes clear.
Okay, good.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
And we're
so abstract. And not it has to be experienced.
Okay, your turn.
What I was experiencing is that when I can push self aside and let self go, get that concept of just letting that go, then there's less attachment to thoughts. Then you can just see thoughts as something the mind creates. There's less attachment to where I'm going when I walk, and more of just the foot is moving forward. And there's just this sense of a little bit of a separation, but enough to kind of be free.
Yeah, thank you. Okay?
Well, I was going to ask you how you experience it in your body. You know, with a contraction or an openness. Rather, yeah, it was like a personal thing.
Thank you.
I was just going to say that it seems to me that there can't be an enduring self, because I'm very aware that the, quote, self that I was when I was a little kid is not the same as the, quote, self that I am now. I mean, I can see that. So I don't see how there can be one.
Thank you. Great. Okay. Yeah.
I noticed in moving from sitting to standing that there began to be that story about self, and so I used labeling, and that really helped just drop the identification. So lifting, moving, shifting, and there was no longer an I doing it, it was just a process happening. Once I was up, I could go back to just not using words, but
yeah,
that was helpful for me.
Great, thank you.
This is such a thing what we talked about so much, but if the Buddha had multiple lifetimes, mm-hmm. and then finally became enlightened in his lifetime and then taught, what was it that was following
mm-hmm.
in his different lifetimes? Mm-hmm. There was something that was in multiple lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. It's the best part. I shut up. It's really great.
I don't know. I'm looking for verification on this too. Is that babies, at some point, there emerges a sense of self.
Correct.
Before that, there isn't a sense of self. But little babies exhibit all the whole range of emotional body. I mean, they're generous, they're loving, they get angry, they go through the whole thing. But in terms of infant psychology, I'm making this up. I don't know that this is true. They are not. They haven't really developed a self in the sense that we're talking about self, an abstract concept of them as a unique entity. That's what I'm understanding.
Okay. All right. Great. Good. Thanks.
I wish that we had gotten to this earlier in the day, because it seems like this mm-hmm. is such a big, thorny, meaty mm-hmm. question, and I can't get anywhere near. I mean, I ended up not moving because I couldn't get anywhere near no self at all. I kept thinking maybe it was something like driving the car somewhere, and you're actually not aware of driving the car, but it still seems that I'm driving the car. So I just couldn't get there.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's kidnap Brooke and make him think her.
Until you've explained it to all of us.
You've got 35 minutes.
Well, I think it's a great place. And first and foremost, it's an investigation. You know, right? It's an investigation. And the Buddha encouraged people to really investigate it. He also said that the subtle sense of self is probably the last, just about the last thing to go. It's one of the two last things to go, the final, you know, movement into being an arhant. And so it's with us for a long ways, that. He also, honestly, was challenging. He would argue with people, and he would ask them to pay attention and stay with it, and then really look at it. And what works is to look at it, I think, very immediately in the little things of life, like lifting a leg, you know, standing, sitting, walking, compassionating. You know, what's really there. And that's it. That's the invitation. As part of that, so I'd like to respond to some of the things that were said or asked, and then we'll see where to go from there. One comment is just, as you said, on the one hand, there are certain ways in which it's actually useful to have a sense of self, which is, I tend to be a little rebellious. You may have noticed it, I don't know, but in the Dharma. And I think about, well, isn't impermanence permanent? Like, right? Or, like, why do we have a self? What's the, you know, so I tackle that. I have two chapters on this. I have especially one chapter on this in my book. And it's a thorny subject. It was the hardest chapter to write, and except for the first one, in many ways the most fun. But, like, self is useful because, you know, if you want to pull over an overhang and you're rock climbing, or your kid has been messed with by some, you know, second grade teacher, there's a certain amount of, you know, Gandalf at the bridge or just you there. No way. You know, I'm not going to let that happen. And also there's a place for self, I think, in intimate relationship where I'm not going to let you down, kid, or I love you. We were talking at the break that I love you is a heck of a lot more meaningful than there is love arising in the space here. Like, okay, guy asked you to marry him, right? There's a lot of love arising in the space here. You want to marry? You know? I don't know. I love you, and I'm going to be for you for the rest of my life. Okay, I'll think hard about that one. You know, there's a big difference. So, and also in evolution, why does self come online? You know, and also why do humans and more advanced animals who have more social emotional capabilities also have a greater sense of self, as evidenced by some rudimentary tests, like they can detect the difference between their body and another body in a mirror. That's called the, like, it's the X thing. You, like, little infant, you put an X on his forehead and show him a mirror, you won't notice anything. Put an X on a cat, they won't do anything about it. Put an X on the forehead of a dolphin, a monkey, or an elephant, they're like, because they know that's me in the mirror. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So me in a very broad sense. Right? So it's useful. That's point one. On the other hand, as you are getting at, one, if you observe in your experience as self increases and decreases, I personally observe an increase and decrease in suffering, right then and there. That self itself carries a subtle contraction. Mm-hmm. Separated from the world, arguably the ultimate in a theistic frame, non-dual frame, the ultimate source of suffering is separation, right? So as selfing arises, there's a sense of separateness that arises, and therefore the suffering that is inherent in separation arises. See for yourself if that's the case. But that's what I observe. It's a subtle sense of contraction. Whereas often that more open out flow, not a lot of Rick floating around, not a lot of story, not a lot of personal history about Rick, not a lot of self-referencing, not a lot of narcissistic injury, no narcissistic injury, you know, no, you talking to me? No, none of that. It's pretty cool, pretty chill, right? Whereas self starts getting going, like, what do you think about me? Do you like me? Is this a good Dharma talk? I don't know. Maybe I could get you to like me more. As soon as you go there, oh my God, it's like walking on razor blades, isn't it? Instantly, instant karma. You know, I love this guy, Stephen Gaskin, right? He and Ina May did Spiritual Midwifery, the farm and Monday night class. I don't know. This takes me back to some of my roots. He defined karma as hitting golf balls in a tiled shower. Instant karma. A lot of life is instant karma. It's not next lifetime or, you know, it's this one, right? Tiled shower. Just whacking the ball. Sidebar, a lot of good parenting, I think, is getting out of the way of the balls flying back to our kids and artfully judging when is it right or wrong to get in the way of that ball coming back at them, you know. But anyway, so, and then on a larger scale, boy, a lot of suffering cascades from selfing, you know. We start taking things really personally. A lot of suffering there, right? Or we want to glorify self. We want to be popular. We live in a very self-glorifying culture, right? We're really focused on image and self-referencing. What do you think about me?
So what's wrong with self-aggrandizement?
How's that working for you? I love the Dr. Phil question, right? And what do we mean? Again, it's really important. What do we mean by that? So that's where that, you know, I'm saying, let's kind of clarify it, not to get linguistic or abstract, but just to be grounded, actually. So aggrandizement, you know, loosely means we're accumulating a lot of stuff here. And as soon as we accumulate it here, suddenly we're a hostage to fate because, you know, living behind a gated community, you're always thinking, who's coming over the hill, right? Whereas, you know, got a lot of stuff, you're always thinking, who's going to take it? That's one thing. Also, if we start pulling it to me, even though we have it for this moment, it embeds anxiety that we might lose it. So that's not so workable. But that's all really different from nourishing the person who happens to wear our name tag. There's a place for that. You know, that's where I talked about filling the hole in the heart, you know, or where, you know, boundless compassion to all beings. Hey, hello, we're one of the all beings, right? Or, it's an interesting point, in if you look at medical care, parenting, school teaching, anything, it's a moral principle that those over whom we have the greatest power, to whom we have the greatest duty, right? Well, of all the beings in this universe, who is the one over whom you have the greatest power? Yeah. Here and now, and especially your future self. I mean, what is so in your life today, for better or for worse, is caused more than anything by the actions of you a decade ago, you know, a year ago, a day ago, right? So that's the person to whom we would want to help the most. So for me, in that sense, there's a wholesomeness to that. Okay. So, okay, suffering. So that's why the Buddha was very interested in that. Now, of the four objects of clinging, that, you know, clinging leads to suffering in the Buddha's model, see for yourself, one of the four is self. So their self is the object that's clung to. That's where we care a lot about reputation, or we get very caught up in how in mistreatment. The question, of course, is what is the middle place, the just right place, where we're not intensely caught up in being aggrieved and wronged and holding on to our reproach. It's a wonderful word, reproach. You know, like, you done me wrong, and you can't make it right. You know, which harms us more than anything. You know, that it's the AA setting, saying, I heard this recently, I love it. Resentment is when I take poison and wait for you to die. Isn't that awesome? Or the Buddha's line, right? Getting mad at people is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both get burned. Both people get burned, right? You did see that. So, but besides being an object of clinging, and you know the others are view, pleasure, sense pleasures, which include avoiding pain, and rites and rituals, or to modernize it, routines, okay? Besides the self being the object, self can be the subject of clinging. And it's true, too, that a lot, when we really get into me, what tends to follow? You know, our hatching our plans to live long and prosper, you know what I mean? But in a big way, to pile up a big pile of toys. Or a big pile of spiritual attainments sometimes. And that's what Trungpa talked about, cutting through spiritual materialism, how the tendency sometimes for people to co-opt spiritual practice into subtle forms of selfing, which we're going to tend to do till we're arhats. So we want to be kind to ourselves about that, but yet, you know, going after it. One of the interesting things to renounce is taking things personally, or, you know, not so much I. Even be careful about how I keeps getting reconstituted constantly. It's interesting to watch what constitutes causes and conditions. You know, it's not an Atman. It's a psychological pattern. I or self is a pattern arising in the mind and therefore the brain. It's a pattern. What that pattern points to doesn't exist in my analysis and certainly vastly greater Bao's, the Buddhist analysis, the Buddha's analysis, okay? But what causes that patterning to increase or decrease? What feeds its nutriment? What are the nutriments that feed it? Okay? And one of the nutriments, interestingly, is language. How often you use the word I, or me, or mine, you know? And it's very interesting. Or that we label things, that we attribute intentionalities to other people, that they did it to me. They had a sense in their mind of the I, their I targeted this I deliberately. So this I is going to teach them a lesson, right? Then we're in trouble. So being careful with language is really interesting. Deliberately watching when we don't need to use words like I or me or mine or self. Can I show you some brain stuff pretty fast? If you look at the next picture, not a big deal. We have plenty of time. We're actually good with time. Dude, if you want to try it, it'll be the next slide. In the brain itself, so... Yeah, exactly. There you go. See, you got to be careful. It's good. It's fun to call this out. But anyway, they looked around. They said, you know, because the traditional notion, right, in the Middle Ages was that the eye was this little homunculus, this little man, little person looking out through the eyes, particularly in the realm, in the region of the pineal gland, supposedly, right? And yet, when you actually put people in an MRI and you have them, let's say, answer a question about what sort of person they are, curious, you know, are you adventure seeking or cautious, Republican, Democrat, do you like donuts, do you like them glazed, do you like vanilla, do you like chocolate, whatever, they're answering questions. Recognize a picture of themselves, distinct from a picture of somebody else who's like them. Or third, and I'll explain the slide in a second, or third, make an important decision, like, or a meaningful decision, a personal choice, right? So that seemed pretty close to at least the Western psychological notion of self. I forget which one they are. One of those activities is represented by the squares, one of those three activities by X's, and one of those three activities by diamonds. And you can see that these are slices of the brain, you know, cut across, kind of top down, and some of them are sideways slices, and some of them are more like front and back slices. Actually, they're all either top down or sideways. Anyway, and you can see those. X's, squares, and diamonds are widely distributed around the brain. So what are the Buddha's three characteristics? Right? Impermanence, interdependence or compoundedness, and suffering due to clinging. As you observe self in your experience directly when you take the body for a walk, you see that self is impermanent, it's transient, it changes, it's variable, it's inconstant. You also see that self is compounded of different parts. You know, there's this part, there's that part, right? And you can also see that clinging to those representations, those eddies arising in the mind, leads to suffering. Same in the brain. In the brain, self is inconstant. It's variable. It's impermanent. Self is also compounded. Brains don't suffer, in a sense. Minds suffer. But of the two of the three characteristics, that's the nature of self in the brain. It's compounded. Right? And interdependent, it dependently arises, and it's impermanent. Any comments or questions about this? Okay. Now I want to talk about one of the really interesting, to me, recent findings in neuroscience that connects to deep practice in a way that I find really practical. And this is, do we have, Kathy, the dual mode theory handout?
It was in your
handouts
I gave you. We have 25. And so the Monday night call, we can bring more tomorrow night.
Oh.
So if you don't take one, then that's the way to...
Yeah. Now this can, and I'll try to stop it from getting a little intellectual. Okay, here's the dual mode theory stuff. How about we hand them out and read, okay? And then here is, of course, one of the all-time great suttas, the teachings to Bahia. You may recall this one. So...
Can we turn off the projector again? So
yeah, I think we can turn it off. Yeah.
Unplug it.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Oh.
Actually, if you can leave it on, I'll show you a picture.
All right,
leave it
on.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. All right,
I don't
need it. Oh, no, I've got one of these.
Okay, there's one teaches the Baha'i, it's a one-sided sheet. If the Monday night people don't take one, we'll have plenty for a video.
I think
there's a two-sided one.
Okay.
What was the other one?
The teachings to Bahia, and there's one called dual mode theory. Yeah, two different handouts. One is printed on two sides. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we'll see. I'll use the one sided one. Okay, now the Monday.
Get over here, girl. That's it.
Who needs a two-sided one? I guess we have less than 25 people here.
Yeah, I think we're good. And then you need one. What's your name?
Frances.
Great. Okay. So, yeah, we have that name tag over there for that person. One person. Okay.
This one. I need a one-sided one.
Well, there you are.
So.
One-sided, two-sided?
One-sided.
Let's start with the Dharma, and then we'll do the neuro. And then we'll finish with the psycho, okay? And then we'll finish with metto as we wrap the day up. Okay. So the Dharma. You may know the Bahia Sutta. I'll just kind of summarize it. Bahia was a very, very developed practitioner of the Buddha's time who heard about the Buddha and wanted to get his teachings. So Bahia came to see the Buddha and said... to the Buddha, noble sir, please give me your teaching. And the Buddha said no. Because he was on alms round or tired or whatever, whatever. But Bahia then again said, noble sir, please give me your teaching. Buddha said no. Second time. And then sometimes these suttas, you don't know what really happened, but I think probably as a teaching device, they bring in high drama. All right, okay, or funny little humor. So, and if, by the way, if you've never done much reading of the actual Pali Canon, especially with a good translation, maybe a little guidance, but just even a good translation with footnotes, like Bhikkhu Bodhi, Tanisaro Bhikkhu is very good, but I really like Bhikkhu Bodhi. Anyway, it's marvelous. It's very clear, and it's got high drama and weirdness in it, and it really drops you back into the time and the place. Anyway, the third time Bahia says, please, noble sir, give me your teaching. And the traditional thing is if you ask three times, you really get it. That's one of the reasons why when we take refuges, we take them three times. Right? You go through it three times. Because that's a traditional thing, three times. And of course, you know, it trains the brain better because you're firing longer. Anyway, so the Buddha turns to Bahia and he gives him a teaching. He said, okay, Bahia. You know, and to me it's like high drama. All right. Right between the eyes. And also, you can take it. He says, okay, you can read this here. So let's do this. Let's start with Francis, if you're willing, and you can always skip. And let's each read a sentence going in the first row and then winding back the second row till we get through the Bahia, the first paragraph, starting with then Bahia. Are you willing, Francis?
You should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen.
In reference to the heard, only the heard.
In reference to the sensed, only the sensed.
In reference to the cognized, only the cognized.
This is how you should train yourself.
When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen.
Keep going.
Only the heard in reference to the heard. Only the seen in reference to the seen. Sense, I'm sorry.
Only the cognized.
Are we keep going?
Yeah, finish the sentence, please.
Only the cognized is referenced to the cognized. Then, bahia, then there's no you in that.
When there is no you in that, there is no you there.
When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder or between the two.
This is the end of all sense of stress.
Or suffering. They translate it as stress. It's also suffering, dukkha. This, just this, is the end of all suffering. Right between the eyes. And in that moment, as the story goes, Bahia was completely awakened. Just all fell away. That's a very seminal teaching. Unfortunately, as you may know, as the story continues, shortly thereafter, Bahia was walking down a road and he was gored by an ox and he died.
Of course.
But when the Buddha was told this, he was glad that Bahia at least had become enlightened before his body died. In any case, that's the teaching here. When there's only the seen, in other words, when there's no I, there's just perception, there may be a Vedana, there's only the thought, there are thoughts there, but there's no you in that. There's just it. It goes on occurring. Eddies keep arising and dispersing as long as there's streaming of incarnate existence with a nervous system that works. There is streaming, but there need not be Bahia there, or Steve, or Rick, or Francis. Now, what might that be in the brain? So this picture, before the slide goes away. In a recent study, what they did is they took people before and after mindfulness training. And then they asked them to do two different kinds of things in the scanner, the MRI. The first thing they asked them to do was to look at a series of what are called trait adjectives and decide whether they apply to themselves or not. And just think about them. Does this fit me? Am I friendly? Am I cautious? Am I curious? Am I ambitious? Am I lazy? You know, who am I? So they're doing a lot of self-referencing in that condition. In the second condition, they ask people to look at the words and just kind of do open, spacious awareness with them. What arises related to that word? What kind of emotions arise? What body sensations arise? What memories arise? What stories arise? Just kind of be aware of whatever arises. So those are the two conditions. Narrative, so-called, is the thinking about how they apply to me, very self-referencing. And experiential is more open, spacious awareness. And what did they find? They found two really remarkable things that are very relevant for us on the path of practice. They found first that in the blue condition, the self-referencing condition, that very midline networks activated. So if you look at the upper right slide, which is in that slide, the person is looking away, so we're seeing the back of their head. You see the two blue areas, those are regions of increased activation. They're right in the middle. There's a lot of midline activation. Okay? Whereas in the open awareness condition, the so-called red or experiential condition, what is much more activated is, in this particular picture, is what are called lateral networks. They're off to the sides. In this picture, they're on the left side. A lot of the time, they're also on the right side. Okay? So the point is, there's a distinction here between midline and lateral. And you could turn it off. It's just fine. But you get the basic idea. So now it's your head right here and now. You can just turn it off. It's great. when you're doing what you're doing right now, which is task-oriented, often self-referenced thinking, or when I do it, there's an awful lot of midline activation. But when we open out into just being with what's there, when there's and there's only the seen, and there's only the heard, and there's only the thought, we're lighting up much more lateral networks. Medial, lateral. Middle, side. That's the first really interesting finding. That distinction between two modes of being. Which, if you look at that handout with two sides, because I've really been playing around with this, you can see these very familiar two different modes that we're commonly aware of. Representing, or very immediately sensory. Lots of verbal activity, little verbal activity. So we have medial on the left, you know, lateral on the right in the two columns, the psychological attributes of the two modes. You see those? So long before people could take pretty pictures in a scanner of a brain, people were noting these two ways of being. Okay? Abstract versus concrete. Future or past versus now. Goal-directed or nothing to do, nowhere to go, and so forth. What's really interesting is that a lot of these distinctions have neurological studies that link the left column to midline activation and the attributes of being, the mode of being in the right-hand column to lateral network activation. For example, panoramic view, side networks, lateral network, the big picture, the 1,000-foot view. Okay? Just kind of a spacious panoramic awareness. I'll say a few more things. Curiosity, don't know mind. Novelty, surprise. Surprise lights up lateral networks. Knowing what it is and thinking about it, midline networks. Okay? Planning. You know, goal-directed activity with a lot of implicit me in it, because it's about me and my life and what I want and what I care about and how I want you to love me, right? Midline networks. Here and now, without attachment, just stuff's happening. Not much clinging present. Lateral light up. Okay? So we have these dual modes. So I'll say, so the first thing that's very cool, which is found in this study, and then I've built on, is that there really is this distinction between two modes of being, both of which are important, which are supported by two very distinct neural networks. That's the first really cool point. And when you start seeing these two modes, you start seeing that they line up. You know, here and now focus tends to be not that verbal, tends to be immediate, tends to be concrete. It is not that clinging focused, usually. There's also not necessarily much sense of I when you were just here and now, you know. Okay? Okay. The second really cool thing is this. Before mindfulness training, when people were in the scanner, they would be directed to do this sort of experiential mode or this more lateral mode of being, and they would briefly light up these lateral networks, but they couldn't sustain it. And then the medial networks would kind of like light up and go, no, 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 you don't, and co-opt them and get back to work in the midline space, right? I think of it sometimes as like, you know, there's a great book called The Ecology of Mind, or, you know, the self is really a committee, or Widman's line, you know, I am multitudes, right? It's a committee up there. It's a big archipelago. It's a zoo. It's a village. Talk about a village, right? Okay, there are certain members of the committee that they like being in charge, and they like their mode because that's how they think they're going to keep you alive. The mind wants to help the being stay alive, in effect. And they just go, no, 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 you don't. And that loosey-goosey here and now way of thinking. Now I'm going to deliberately throw a little provocative coal on, you know, log on the fire. None of that feminine thinking. We got to be masculine to get the job done and survive.
It's interesting that concrete is lateral.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah,
too.
It's very lateral.
Why would concrete be lateral? It seems if you're doing concrete thinking, you're very focused.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to abstract thinking.
What's this concrete versus abstract? You think abstract would be lateral?
Abstract meaning conceptual?
I don't know.
Or linguistic. Well, that's what abstract means. Yeah. Conceptual and often linguistic is really associated with midline activity. But when we're just being with the thing itself, in the immediacy of it, as it is, without much linguistic action, right, or much conceptualization about it, very zen, right, very, then it's a lot of a right brain. And classically, and I threw it in just to be a little provocative, classically, men or masculine mental activity is seen as more abstract, more conceptual, whereas feminine women and historically in feminine mental activity is seen as more concrete and immediate. Men tend to think about values and causes and flags waving in the breeze. Women tend to think about, what's this going to do to my hearth and my home here and now? I'm deliberately saying provocative things. Obviously, you can switch that a lot. And people have described it in that way. See what I mean? So anyway, my point is that this midline tends to be sort of the big bosses. Well, what's very interesting is that with mindfulness training, just an, I think it was an 8-week or 6-week, you know, probably 20 minutes a day course for college sophomores or something, they could sustain and stabilize lateral activation, lateral network activation, and sustain this open space awareness mode without it being hijacked or co-opted by midline activity that's intensely self-referencing. Isn't that a trip to think about? That a lot of what we're doing when we're training the mind is that, and training the brain, therefore, one outcome is being able to sustain these lateral networks, and we stimulate and strengthen. We strengthen them by stimulating them, right? We wire them by firing them. We stimulate and strengthen them. We then are able to drop increasingly into this mode, this lateral mode of presence, here and now, not know, immediate, not much I, not much striving, not much clinging. What happened? What is there not much of when there's not much clinging?
Suffering.
Yeah, not much self and not much suffering, right? Wow. So, what are some things as takeaways that really tend to light up the lateral networks? Because if you know what lights up those lateral networks, even transiently without mindfulness training, then you can do things to increasingly stabilize that. And some of this, these are practices I've actually started really exploring personally. One is a panoramic view. And I think that's, again, why so many traditional instructions talk about things like sky, sky gazing in Tibetan Buddhist practice, opening out, boundlessness. You know, it's that spaciousness. Okay? Another thing that that activates lateral networks is curiosity, which is at the heart of the investigation factor of enlightenment. Some people say of the seven factors of awakening, investigation is the most important because it drives the rest of them. Yeah. And that's what we have done so much this weekend, haven't we? We've just said, all right, deep end of the pool, strap on the tank, let's investigate. Right? That's what we've done. It's a very powerful function. It's curiosity serves that. How interesting. And it keeps also generating alertness. Another thing that supports lateral network activation is not needing the moment-to-moment contents of mind to relate to each other. Sokni Rinpoche had this great little line. He said, the problem is not that thoughts arise, or that it's not that the problem is not that there's thoughts. The problem is that we glue them together. Right? We kind of construct relationships between them. Whereas if you're in this more lateral mode, doesn't it seem one way into it is to not need them to relate to each other? Which kind of goes a little bit to disenchantment about the eddies in the stream, or not making them I who made the eddies happen. They're just arising and dispersing. They don't even need to relate. Swirling sticks and twigs here, swirling leaves there, no eddies at all, a new swirl comes along, traces and laces of foam. They don't have to relate to each other. You know, a thought, a feeling, a sensation.
That really helps break through no self, because it's like, oh, where'd that one come from? Wow, what's that? Oh, look at that one. You know, because if you're not linking them together and then constructing a story and going down your canyon,
right, exactly.
They're just bubbles, that thing about bubbles arising.
Yeah.
So it's like, wow, where'd that, you know, that's not me.
That's right.
I didn't make that happen. Right.
So great.
That's a place to see it for me.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, yeah, it's a great practice. What's interesting is that the lateral networks, remember those pictures in one of the slide sets, are these networks. I did it yesterday. It's one of the first few, the connectome, I think. It looks like, you know, like if you look at satellite pictures of the U.S. at night, you see these laces, and rural areas like Nevada don't have a lot of lights, and then around Reno there'd probably be some in Las Vegas and a few lights in the highways, but it's pretty quiet, pretty dark. The lateral networks are more like that. The density of connectivity is a lot looser. Whereas the medial networks, they look like the transportation hub between Boston and New York. Really, really dense activity. And I think that's why when we're in the medial mode, it really feels like things are intensely connected to each other. Whereas when we're more in this lateral mode, you know, the subjective experience corresponds in some ways to the objective material nature of the neural substrate, which is more dispersed, less tightly connected, more loosey-goosey, more it's okay. So.
It seems odd that the brain would have evolved to have these different sections, the medial part seeming the one that gets you through the day, gets you avoided by the tiger, you don't get run over by another car.
Yeah.
The lateral one gives you more social interactions and how to make your day-to-day interactions with other human beings function in your life. Yeah. There would be this battle between, I mean, you would think that these would operate, I mean, would operate independently, and one would come on when this was on, and one would come on when the other of it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like in some ways we end up doing, you know, lateral activities with our medial brain sometimes, and we do medial activities with our lateral brain some of the time. You know?
I think that's so true. I also think culture has a lot to do with it. Because just if you play with this dual mode, what does this look like? Civilization, noble savage. Classically, you know, and which is why I think it's important to be thoughtful about how, to me, this side has been discriminated against and pathologized and oppressed. That's why I threw that log on the fire about masculine feminine. Yeah, it has. Artists often are in this mode. Some of our most creative people go on a long trip into the lateral networks. And then come back and tell us about it. You know, the great artist. But also, I remember Einstein, who very curiously, A, he was slow to learn language. He talked late. He was like three-ish or so when he talked. B, autopsy of his brain, a part of his brain that's particularly big, is involved in visual awareness. And C, his own story is that he got it about relativity. The problem for him was finding a language to describe it. See what I mean? So it's not just the artists and the poets or the mystics who go out here and come back and tell, bring back, like Prometheus, the fire from their journey. It's also the great scientists sometimes too. But I think we live in a cultural world, which is one reason why I think Waldorf's pretty cool, although you can go too far with it, where we excessively train this mode. We fire these neurons a lot. Right? We expect four-year-olds to start reading or something, or start planning, or we load homework on kids, so they need tons and tons of executive function. Executive functions live in the midline mainly. All right? And so we build it up. And we also have this very intense sense of agency in I. What are you going to make of yourself, kid? All right? It's I. Whereas people who are much more in this mode, by nature, define themselves much more as the village, right? Jack Kornfield has a saying, if you ask an African, how are you doing, particularly one who lives more in the country, let's say it's a woman, she'll say, we're doing great. Our village, we had a wonderful crop this year. Or, how are you doing? I'm doing horribly. You know, there's been a baby died down the street or something. I listened on retreat recently to a woman introduce herself who's Native American, and another Native American introduced himself, and it was so startling. They introduced themselves not like, I'm Rick Hansen, I'm a psychologist, you know, I live in Marin, and you know, I have a PhD or whatever, but no, I am so-and-so, I am the Red on Running Water clan, on my mother's side, and on this and that, and I am this network, I am, right? I am this lateral network, So that's another reason, I think, that we go medial. Yeah.
We're talking a lot about medial and lateral. Have they disproved the right brain, left brain theory?
Well, there's a lot of theory, right brain, left brain. Generally, we talked a little bit yesterday, so I'll say that in kind of a more summary way today, that the left is more specialized for most people, or linear processing, including language processing, and the right much more for holistic spatial processing. The right also handles a lot of spatial awareness and threat detection. So these lateral networks are also very useful for threat detection, which tends to come in from the periphery, if you think about it. So, yes, indeed, there is often a distinction. What's interesting is that you can remove the entire hemisphere of a toddler or infant, one side or the other, because of catastrophic epilepsy, let's say. And by age 20, you need really sophisticated neural tests to discern any kind of impact. Even if you take out the left hemisphere, they'll develop language functions on the right. Right? You know, they'll use it. But the point is, there still is a difference. But what I'm describing is not left hemisphere versus right hemisphere. It's midline versus lateral. Right? Or I think of it a little bit like this. It's the capital versus the provinces, which you can sense in your own awareness, right? Ego is midline. Subpersonalities, for better or worse, are more laterally located, you know, out there in the shadows of the village. Okay, a couple more, then we'll move to a wrap, okay?
My friend Neil, and we drove past the sign the other day that said, Reno's best academic preschool.
Oh, great. Yeah, let's start early. And there's a place for some things, especially for really bright kids, okay. But there's a lot to be said for, you know, nourishing the sense of mystery. A panoramic view, not knowing, curiosity, not being burdened by the need to be a strong agent. You want to activate I? Put pressure on people to produce results on a deadline. Yeah. Right? Or risk social shame. Light it up like a Christmas tree in Times Square. Right there. Right? Right? So if we want to not do that, you know, we go in the other direction.
I wanted you to talk a little about the fourth one down on the second page on the left-hand side. More reverberation and incursion. That was what
I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. So upper left on my or your slice, it depends. But so on the left-hand column, there's something called more reverberation and recursion. A few second slice of now versus immediate and transient. This is a little technical, but it's kind of interesting. Like, have you ever noticed that now, intellectually, we understand that now has got to be vanishingly thin, right? Like, if you throw a ball up, you know, if we throw something up in the air, if we throw it straight up and straight down, or we throw it this way, up or this way, there is a point at the top of that trajectory where it has zero motion, right? It's not going up or down. It has zero motion in terms of the vertical axis, right? Can you see that? Weird as that is, it actually happens. There is a point, even though it looks continuous, there is a point where it has zero motion. Now, the duration of that interval is vanishingly small. Okay. We know intellectually that the now is vanishingly small. Be here now. What do you mean now? You know what I mean? But do we experience the duration of now as vanishingly small? We don't, actually. Now feels like it's kind of almost like a second or two long, right? That's how people experience it. And that's how you, it's kind of like you now sort of fades away in the back and comes into being in the front. And the duration of that interval feels like a second or so or two. How can that be? Well, a way it is that we get these loops, which I showed you some of the pictures of, these traffic patterns, you know, the Reno-Tahoe, the Reno-Vegas loop, the Boston-Manhattan loop. That's recursion. That's what recursion means. You're getting looping, you know. Like Gödel, Escher, Bach. You're getting recursive loops so that you're aware of awareness of awareness. For example, see that? And now, in the midline, you have a lot of looping. So I think that when we're in that midline mode, this was just sort of a hunch that I threw in, but I think it's interesting. When we're in that midline mode, because there's a lot of looping there, our subjective experience feels like now is longer. It's just a detail. But when we're more in that lateral mode, we're much more aware of things disappearing. Remember, one of the strongly encouraged meditative practices is to observe endings. Right? We observe things ending. And it's hard to observe things ending when your sense of now is long. But if your sense of now is quite thin, you can really be in the... I mean, things are gone almost as fast as they arise. Right? And I think what supports that is lateral activation. Because it doesn't have those dense recursive loops in the neurology of it all, in the circuitry. It's lighter. It's stuff just flows through. Patterns emerge and then they're gone. They don't recur. They don't persist that long. They're just gone, gone,
so
gone.
So you weren't talking about recurrent thoughts.
No.
You're talking about recurrent.
I'm talking about something being maintained in awareness as a stable pattern longer. That happens more when you're in that medial mode. It was like a passing comment, kind of interesting neurologically, that it makes sense because the anatomy is different in the medial versus lateral.
Do these get denser if you meditate?
That's a great question. No one knows. I don't know. I doubt they do. Bows. I will wrap up momentarily, okay? And I'll happily stick around for a little bit, although I need to get on the road soon. So maybe another question or comment, and then let's do a brief practice. Okay? So someone had their hand up. Yeah?
I just had a quick question. The density of the mid-range area, scientifically, is that because of overuse?
It's probably anatomically designed to be home base in evolution because it really activates when you feel threatened. And you need to deal. Or there's an important goal that you need to sustain striving for. Well, if you want to keep monkeys alive to pass on their genes, you want them to get good at that. Or even squirrels or dogs, right? But certainly primates or early humans, let's say. And then second along comes culture, right? That really, really tends to train that. But again, we are, as I said yesterday, we are in the early, early days of all this stuff. You know, no one really knows. Like, just imagine taking a longitudinal study. No one has taken a snapshot of this, as you were saying. You know, infants, toddlers, preschoolers, grade schoolers, high schoolers, college, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 80s, 90s, dead. And then autopsy, the brains to see. Like, who knows? Meditators versus non-meditators. And which is tough, because how do you randomly assign people to the meditation group or the non-meditation group? Sorry, you don't get to practice spiritually in this life. Better luck next one. You know, okay. But for me, the takeaway, again, is to use this neuro stuff and these pretty pictures with a lot of not knowing and grains of salt to support the conviction factor. Like, what I'm doing makes a difference. And that's also why it could be useful to work hard to do something and to try to stabilize something that tends to crumble frequently and to just stick with it, right? And as a practical matter, in practice, I think it's quite useful to use concentration in the beginning, everything we learned yesterday, to develop a stability of awareness that can then pop out into open space and sustain that open panoramic awareness and allow and nourish liberating insight. Micro liberations, and then bigger and bigger ones as we go down the path. And even big ones in the beginning of the path, right? To me, that's what's useful to do. To me, that's what makes sense from everything we've talked about today. And along the way, keep taking in the good, really. If there's one, you know, whatever you do here, do. But, you know, the stance of being for yourself and helping yourself on the path through taking in the good to reward yourself for the things that are difficult but good for you, as well as the things that are easier or good for you, that's a major takeaway. And every day of your life, you can really be changing your neural structure and your mind and your whole experience of living as you go down that road. Okay, any last comment or question? And then we'll do a brief practice.
Just a quick procedural question.
Yeah.
You didn't get to a lot of patients here. And I wondered, do you have another, have you given this similar talk before where those who are interested could hear the end?
Well, they all vary because workshops really vary, you know. And I thought there was no shortage of density of application here.
Okay.
And yeah, on my website, wisebrain.org, or our website, you can look at the two workshops have been done so far in self. And the part that you haven't heard particularly, partly I didn't honestly think you needed it because it's listed there, are the practices to release self. And we did a lot of them along the way in the slides. And you can see those, you can listen to the talk about them, which, and I think the talks in each one of those workshops were rushed in there in those cases. But you can also see them as practices. And they're also what the Buddha recommended. You know, the Buddha recommended certain very specific practices, a lot through investigation, that would release attachment to self and have insight to self. Also, it is true that in Buddha's brain, I do list out a lot of these things. And okay, so they're available in that way. Okay, any other comment as we wrap?
I like John Wilson's quote. Sorry, Gary.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That I is a survival strategy. Yes.
So I was thinking about the open spaciousness. When I'm in this open spaciousness, I don't seem, you can see this huge, you know, from the world when it first started to when it's going to end type of thing. And then I get into a space where I don't really care about the day-to-day things. But then I think, now where does caring come in? Where do you care about, you know, who to vote for and how to, you know, the daily things about caring?
Well, how about I comment on that and lead us into a little practice? So the comment is, it's of course a wonderful question. You know, there we are, not self. Why care? Why bother? Right? Or the Hell's Angel model. Live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse. Right? And it's really, so the answer, though, yeah, the answer, though, is it's what we've talked about, and, you know, which is the importance of having compassion and kindness for this being as one of among all beings. And out of compassion and kindness for this being and also other beings, there's a natural movement into thoughtfulness and skillfulness and caring. We naturally want to help, right? We do. And so that's, and yet, there doesn't need to be self-referencing, or there needs to be only the lightest possible self-referencing to do that. What do the arhants do? Do they stop teaching? Do they stop participating? Do they stop helping? Do the people who have very little sense of I, they're very empty? Dipama, described as very empty, passionately committed to serving and helping. I mean, what does Dipama mean? Mother of Dipa. She was defined verbally as the mother of Dipa, you know, her daughter. So, you know, that's part. And so I'll tell you a little story and lead it into a practice. So on a retreat, I was right in this consideration and very aware of the sense of allness and aware of how any part of the all is transient and not special. Right? Allness persists, but any part of it, a tree, a squirrel, a rick, not special, not important. And that plunged me into despair. I could hardly sleep all night. You know how sometimes you have these realizations that are sort of blissful initially, and then it's like, you know? So it plunged me into despair, and it got me right at my narcissistic wounds. You mean I'm not important? You know, you mean I need to give up? I mean I can never really be important? Hey, that's my mother's strategy for me, I never be important? Holy moly. Then, you know, I hardly slept all night. I remember it quite vividly. And then I went out for a walk in the early morning on Spirit Rock, down by the kitchen early morning, made myself some coffee, and hung out, just like, wow. And what I started noticing were all the little critters. You know, the little mice, actually, or little beetles, little birds moving around. And I just watched how enterprising they were, just doing stuff, getting food, caring, you know, being helpful, taking care of their kids. And then this doe and her three fawns came down the hillside by me, just nearer than those bookcases over there, or not much farther. And I watched her with them, protecting them, taking care of them, you know. And I looked at them and I thought, they have a place in the all. It's okay for them to be in the all. They're part of the all, and their being here is helpful. Like they're contributing in their own way, right? The beetles are contributing in their own way. The birds are contributing in their own way. And then I got, well, I'm a critter just like them. I'm in the all. I'm not more or less important or special, but for this life, there's a place for me in the all. Just like for each one of the persons that we are. There's a place for us, each one of us, in the all. It's good to be enterprising. It's our nature to be enterprising in our own way, depending on who we are, etc. And through being ourselves and being who we are and so forth, we send out ripples of contribution to others. Wow. Very far out. Like, okay. And then a little later, I walked and I walked on this little trail and a gray squirrel popped down not that far away. Like, this is the tree, that's the squirrel. And a very odd thing happened. You may have had these experiences where an animal is just present with you, you know, way past the normal script. And you're present with it way past the normal script. So I'm looking at that squirrel, and it's just looking at me, you know, and, right, like we're with each other. And there was a very strong feeling of wishing that squirrel well as an organism. And paradoxically, in the back of the mind then came, you know, wishing the owl well that it may find a squirrel, right? But wishing that squirrel well, may you find nuts. I don't know, or, you know, male or female, may you find a partner. May you live long. And in that was also the very strong sense that I was like the squirrel. I could wish well to this being too, which is the theme I've really been, you know, speaking to today. And so it's really okay at an emotional level to wish well to this being too. It has a place for that. There's a place for that, right? And wish well that this being avoid the owls of life, you know, and get many nuts and keep them safe in its tree and have many, you know, friends and ripples and children, perhaps, that ripple out for out, right? That's true. That's deeply true. So how about we do a little practice of well-wishing, beginning with ourselves and then rippling out to all beings. So I'll basically be quiet here. See if you can find a place, perhaps embodied through breathing in the heart, of well-wishing, goodwill to yourself. With it, perhaps, may come some insight that the enactment of good wishes and compassion for yourself involves, perhaps, a few changes. A little more of this, a little less of that. That actually would be the kindest, best thing you could do for yourself, certainly in the next chapter of your life. In other words, this day forward. And then in your own time for the next few minutes, after doing that with yourself, if you like, extending that further out to other beings. May our sincere efforts today help ourselves and others be free of suffering and its causes. Thank you so much. Enjoy.